Maybe the reason you are so interested in all this is because we like to be in control of things that are inevitable anyway, like death is inevitable. We don't want other people making that choice for us, do we? Especially some random stranger. I say especially, but we don't want our loved ones to either, but they're usually the ones that do it. Yeah. So, but things are inevitable, just like the seasons are inevitable. Like my fictionalized person's friend kept saying, winter is coming. Well, of course winter is coming. It's inevitable. Death is inevitable, but we want control over it, right?
Jerry took pictures of his victims in select clothing because that was part of his fantasy. He's probably living in a fantasy about his mother. And for him, he had sexualized that. And so he would dress them up in women's certain clothing that he wanted that would make him feel better about himself and perhaps harken him back to a time when life was safer for him. So Jerry, if you stand back as a scientist and you look at his behavior, Jerry was exploring his sexual interest in him and how he could act out, take trophies, act with impunity. He was doing things he'd been fantasizing about for a very long time.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, retired FBI profiler, former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer of CBS's Criminal Minds. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard, and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, and I have a real interest in real crime and these minds that solve those crimes.
Well, today we have a very special guest and friend of ours.
Hello, I'm John White. I'm a former Dallas police sergeant. And presently, I'm a professor of psychology at Stockton University, just outside of Atlantic City. And I'm also a forensic psychologist.
That's awesome. Thank you for joining us, John. It's really good to see you.
Good to see you, too.
Yeah, it's great to have you on, John. And I last saw you in New Orleans, actually, at CrimeCon.
Yes. Yes, the Crime Con is a very, very great conference.
Yes, and you were speaking there both. Well, in fact, we saw you in Nashville as well, Nashville and the New Orleans Crime Con.
Yeah.
Yes, I was very graciously asked to participate with Jim during the Nashville conference, and I did speak at the Crime Con, of course, on serial killers in New Orleans.
Well, John, in your introduction, you failed to mention that you're also an author, and you've written one of the most powerful and scary serial killer novels I've ever read, and you also have a database of serial killers that you use to teach your students and people around the country and around the world about serial killers, right?
Right. A few years ago, I started this database with some graduate students. And we've slowly built it up to about 550 killers with 164 variables for each. So we're presently correlating different variables and seeing what we can get out of it. And yes, I did write a book. It's called In Pursuit of a Serial Killer, The Archetype Case, which I'm glad you read, and thank you for the nice commentary on it. It's based on some of my police experiences in Dallas, but it's fiction. It's a fiction book. But all the information about the different serial killers that I talk about in the book is real. The information about them is correct and didn't make anything up with them.
Cool.
Our listeners can't see, but I'm holding it up because I'm reading it at the moment. And
oh, there it is. Yep.
There it is.
Well, we'll post it on our site.
I was just about to say, we will put it into our show notes so that our listeners can also look it up, and maybe Lisa would do a book club on it.
Yeah.
I can certainly tell, you know, within the first couple of chapters that it is a lot of your experience in here talking, and a blend of different characters as well. And you were also our technical consultant on our show Killer Profile, which aired in 2013, which Jim and I did with Jim Fitzgerald, where we talked through six cases of serial killers. And we really did a psychological autopsy. So if our listeners haven't watched that show, well, Professor John White was our technical advisor, and every episode is a different case. And we really deep dive into not just the killer, but also the victim
right.
that each prolific killer targeted. And as everyone knows, we talk about victimology a lot and the crime scene assessment. So that was 2013. It was some time ago now.
Yeah, how time flies. Jeez.
Yeah, and in that show, Killer Profile, we focused on cases that weren't as popular in the genre. People didn't really know about these offenders, but these offenders were very bad people, very prolific offenders. But the one distinction they had was in each case, at least one victim got away. And we wanted to focus on cases in which the victim's desire to live overcame the offender's desire to kill them. And so that people will learn that just because you're in the clutches of a serial killer doesn't necessarily mean that it has to be the end of your life. That there's certain things that kick in, and these victims were, these survivors, let me call them, were able to figure out a way to escape or to get them to release them. And of course, went right to the police. And then the offender was arrested pretty quickly.
Yeah, and that happens in a lot of cases where some of these serial killers get a little cocky. They don't know, they feel like they're not vulnerable to anything. And that's what people have to watch for. Like you said, hopefully never will happen, but if you are in the clutches of these guys, they'll make a mistake if you just keep watching and keep hope.
So, John, I know when we talked in Nashville, I gave a presentation called Preventing Murder in Slow Motion, and I talked about a lot of cases where serial killers had targeted women, but also domestic violence-related cases. And I talked about the concept of coercive control and the fact that we'd changed the law in England and Wales following a very successful 12-month campaign, which highlighted overwhelming and compelling evidence for change. And we're the first country in the world to criminalize. And I remember you coming up to me after the presentation and saying that you were really interested to look at your database because you felt that in many of the cases where the perpetrators had had relationships and had married, that coercive control was present. But it was a new term to you at the time. Do you remember that conversation?
Yes, I do remember that. And It's a new term. I know Jim's colleagues, Roy Hazelwood, and some of his colleagues had looked at something called compliant control, which is similar, but it's not exactly what you're talking about with coercive control. And I think I mentioned a couple of killers in the database that I knew offhand, and one of them was Jerry Brudos. In the 50s, he killed five young ladies. You know, most of these guys are control freaks anyway. They're very much control freaks. And a lot of the data says that they are abusive to their wives and family. But Brudos really stands out to me because he made her do things like vacuum and do housework, totally naked, except wearing high heel shoes. Now, he was a paraphiliac. He had a shoe fetish and a foot fetish. And he pushed that on to his wife so that he could continue those sexual feelings and that sexual fantasy that he had with shoes. But he made her do all kinds of things sexually. And it was only after their daughter became older that the mother felt like she couldn't just comply with his rules and regulations anymore. And so then she started rebelling. And interestingly, that's when Brudos started killing outside and raping. He raped a few women before he started killing. But that was one of the initial aspects that started this, was he was losing control over his wife at that point.
And yes, you call that compliant control, Dr. White. You call that compliant control?
Well, it was written about before regarding sexual sadists, the wives of sexual sadists. by Roy Hazelwood, a former FBI profiler.
Yeah, but that's and you point that out, and that's a good thing to point out. But I have the same problem with Ken Lanning's discussion about compliant victimization in child sexual victimization cases. When somebody grooms you into victimization, it's not really compliant because you're not in control. Two, you're being manipulated, and so it looks like compliant control. But what it is actually coercive control. It's coercive in a way that sometimes is very positive things are given, and sometimes very negative things, and sometimes all across that spectrum. But there's always been a little bit of pushback, but I think it is the sort of history of the behavioral analysis unit to have that compliant word in these situations when really the operative term is the coercion or manipulation. So it should have been manipulative control or coercive control, not compliant victimization. So manipulative victimization.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I understand that. I think what they were speaking of, and this is the confusion, I believe, is that they're looking only at what the victim does, and the victim does what the person says. Right. But I do agree. It's more of a coercive and a manipulation and a grooming more than compliant from a mental aspects. You know,
right. Like
if my mother told me to do something, I would do it. I would be compliant. Sometimes she would tell me and I'd be scared, so I did it. Sometimes I wanted to do it. So there is that big distinction between I want to do this on my own volition versus do it because I'm scared to death.
Right.
Yeah, and under fear and duress, which most of these cases, when I always say when fear is in the room, then you don't consent to something. You are being forced to do something. And I think, I mean, I deep dived the case again after we spoke about Jerome Brudos. And of course, many of our listeners saw this case on Mindhunter.
Yes.
And we talked about it then, the three of us on when we were talking about Mindhunter. But I just want to give a context, because when he married, he was 22, Jerome Brudos, and she was 17.
Right.
So she was a child, effectively, at 17 years of age. Her name was Darcy Metzel, and he was 22 years of age. So we do know with younger victims that they are more malleable and much more impressionable and naive. And he gave her very strict rules that she had to follow and
orders.
And you mentioned one of them about the having to be naked and wearing high heels, but she also wasn't allowed to go in certain areas of the house.
Right. Well, his garage. She was not allowed to go into the garage because that's where his workshop was. And that's where he also hung women from chains.
Yeah. And by workshop, you mean torture chamber.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. I mean, let's not give him the benefit of the doubt here. I mean, he would abduct and torture and kill people. And he was able to prevent discovery by coercively controlling his wife, who, as just pointed out, really just sexually victimizing. I mean, he married her as a child to control her. I mean, it's just the guy was very good at planning and controlling people. And what do you think? Did you see Mindhunter? Did you see the series?
Yes, I saw it.
And what did you think about their depiction of Brudos and other serial killers?
I thought it was excellent. And it was, and I think I mentioned to Laura, the idea of them giving him a shoe to bring out some, it was just, you know, you never hear of that. You never heard of that before. So that was quite ingenious on their part to do that.
Was that true, Jim? Did they really bring a shoe? Do you know?
I don't know, but certainly it's the kind of thing that Roy Hazelwood and John Douglas taught us to do. So I imagine that was from experience.
Yeah, I think that was Douglas's idea, and Ressler was not particularly for it at the time. I think they had a little conflict.
Yeah, well,
incidentally, Darcy's parents really objected to that marriage. And
they did?
Yes, and there was some speculation that one reason Darcy married him in the first place was just to get back at her parents.
Rebellion?
Yeah.
Well,
so it's interesting she would rebel against her parents, but then come under complete control of Jerome Brudos.
Well, I've seen that in a number of cases, and in fact, a case at the moment that I'm working on where, again, she was a teenager, she was beautiful, absolutely stunning. And she was, on her 18th birthday, she married a man who was incredibly controlling. And so it was a real rebellion to her parents. They were so strict and religious that it was her sort of rebellion to them. And so she went straight out of the frying pan and into the fire, because he did end up killing her through coercive control. Mm-hmm. And so I do see that a lot in cases where, you know, and it may be that it's about being strict, but you can also get victims who are being abused at home. And of course, they see this as an escape, and who the perpetrator may present as can be the charming side to them. You know, and wining them, dining them, and being older, younger girls do tend to be, you know, wooed and attracted to older men. So that doesn't surprise me, sadly. And that's another side to vulnerability that these predators really do pick up on.
The hallmarks of psychopathy are this lack of empathy, a sense of entitlement, narcissism. Most serial killers are psychopaths. It is the personality disorder that allows them to commit a homicide and come up and deal with their family as if nothing's happened.
And a lot of these predators are master manipulators, and they're narcissistic, and some women see that as confidence. And they feel protected by them, but that narcissism sometimes turns into what we call a malignant narcissism, with antisocial traits and a type of sadism that's involved with it.
Mm-hmm. But this is also why we have laws to protect children from their own behavior, from their own bad decisions. They're not fully developed. They're not mature enough to make decisions about relationships and so forth. And so I really have a problem where the federal law says that you're a child till you're 18, but in many states, you can get married as young as 16, 15, 14. At one point in Arkansas, you could get married with parental consent at age 12.
That's insane.
It's unbelievable.
Wow. Yeah.
You should look at that as abuse. You know, the fact that parents will give away their kid at age 12, that should be seen as abuse. I've seen judges who take that to the extreme, where when a child is being sexually victimized, one judge, I believe it was either in Washington, D.C. or Maryland, said to the victim, well, it takes two to tango. You know, it's mm-hmm. part your fault. And it's just unbelievable in this day and age that people are still that ignorant about how easily children are manipulated and coerced and abused. Just
yeah, in California, there is no age limit for you. If you're 2 years old, you could be married off to somebody. There's a strange blue law that you can, if your parents consent. So, and there are, you know, many lawmakers who are trying to change that law, but yeah, isn't that incredible?
Crazy.
Yeah,
that's unbelievable. Just absolutely crazy psychologically and physically. That's crazy.
I mean, what do you think? I mean, when should people be allowed to give away their kids for marriage to somebody?
Well, I didn't give away my daughter until she was 40.
Okay, there you go.
Well, I also just want to throw in, you know, as a feminist, I struggle with people giving away, as if, you know, daughters are possessions.
Stop, stop protecting. That's the
not.
Legal. Right, I know, but that's the legal way they say it. But what it is when should parents have to protect their kids? Until what age? That's the proper way to say it. And it's not just their daughters. I assume the same thing happens with sons. I mean, an older woman can marry a younger son, and there has to be some consent by the parents when they're still a child. So,
well, I know it's been said over and over that the human brain in general is not totally mature. And when I say mature, the wiring in the brain is not complete. The white matter is not complete until a person's around 25 or so. Mm. But the way our generations have been, at least, at the very least, 18, because we send our kids off to war. We send our kids off to college. They are going to be on their own. as far. So it's kind of a hypothetical question as to when how long right. should they do that. I know the laws said that you had to allow them to be on your insurance until you're 26 here in New Jersey. So, you know, 25, 26 is when people really begin to make proper or have the capacity to make proper decisions. Of course, I know some 30-year-olds that don't. I have a room full of sex offenders on Wednesday nights that are in their 30s and 40s, and they didn't make good decisions. Mm. So it's really relevant to the person themselves, I guess. But
you said you have a room full of people in their 30s and 40s that made bad decisions. So you treat sex offenders?
Yes, I do. I treat adult sex offenders and juvenile sex offenders.
Okay, and I know that there's people ask me all the time, can they be treated? Can you change someone who is for example, a preferential sex offender, somebody who is sexually attracted, let's start with, to prepubescent children, a pedophile? Can you actually change someone who is a pedophile? Can you change their sexual attraction?
Well, first of all, most sex offenders are impulsive, regressive, what we call regressive. They're situational, not preferential. And that's the majority of sex offenders.
But how do you have that data? Where are you getting that data? You mean
in my groups,
okay,
they have been men and a few women, but men who are not preferential to children. And in the data, when you read about the pedophilic behavior, you have the regressive and then you have the preferential. It is very difficult to change or have them want to change, because a psychologist doesn't change you. The psychologist gives you the tools, mainly through what we call cognitive behavioral therapy, to change that behavior. We give you the tools. And in most of the very impulsive time, when I say impulsive, yes, the first one may, and then they have two or three or four or five victims, but they also have adult relationships, most of them. And they want to carry on with those adult relationships. And they really, most of them really do not want to do what they're doing after they see the ramifications of it and go to therapy. And they are changeable. The ones you cannot change, or you cannot get them to want to change themselves, are the psychopathic, preferential pedophiles. They won't change. Or the preferential sadistic person who is a psychopath. You cannot change that person, or they generally do not want to be changed.
Right, but I would also add loving pedophiles as well, and I'm using air quotes when I say loving, but people who fall in love with children, literally fall in love with them, they're fixated only on children. I mean, that they're never going to change either.
Yeah, there's got to be something more to that. What is causing that? What is causing that love of children? And if it's, you know, there's some research that says it's genetic.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to go that far. But, you know, that it's a sexual orientation, just like heterosexuality, homosexuality, and pedophilic behavior. I'm not ready to go there. I don't think the research is going to back that up. But that's different. I mean, I've had guys who have fallen in love with kids, and I have this one guy in particular, fell in love with this boy of the woman that he was dating, and then he married her simply to be around this boy.
I've had hundreds of cases like that, literally hundreds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Doctor, are the people you're treating, are they incarcerated, or is this an outpatient?
No, they are released and court-ordered to go to treatment.
Oh, okay.
These are people living in society.
Okay.
But all right, but you're saying he fell in love with this boy and he married her. I've seen people, one, get into relationships to produce children so they could have, they'll wait 12 years the whole time planning the victimization of that child.
Yes.
They date only women with children because they want to get access to the child.
Yes, I've had several cases like that.
Right, but the fact is that these people, when you say there has to be something more to it, Why do you not believe that it is ingrained in birth? In other words, why is it, if they literally have a, you know, from the time they hit puberty till the time they die, they are sexually fixated on children. Let's just deal with pedophiles because that's the easiest group to define, that they are only sexually attracted to prepubescent children. It's certainly not a choice, right? It's not something you can say one day, oh, I think I'm going to be attracted to little kids.
No, I don't think it's a choice.
Right. No. So
it's how do you control your behavior when you feel those urges?
No, I know, but most people don't feel those urges. What I'm saying is, why do they feel the urge? Why do they have that sexual attraction?
Oh, if we could answer that, we would be very famous.
But isn't it simply the same as everybody else's sexual attraction?
Well, these people who are saying that it's genetically based are saying that there is a stronger urge. So yeah, I guess in a way you could say that. It's always ending up being a resultant of that urge. But do people choose their sexual orientation? Do they choose to be sadists? Do they choose to? That's the big question in psychology right now. Yeah. The vast majority of research indicates that we are genetically predispositioned for our sexual behavior, predisposition for violence, and then the environment is what carries that out.
Yeah, but also
it's the nature and the nurture.
Yeah, and
Jerome Brudos, then, you know, we know in his psychological autopsy that his mother was abusive to him and wanted a daughter and dressed him up in girls' clothes, but he was playing with high heels and putting them on at the age of 5. And, you know, all of his wiring and who he was as a child, he was acting out from a very young age. And as a teenager, he was stalking women as a teenager. So there were lots of red flags about him. But the domestic abuse aspect, I think, is overlooked a lot. You can have the gene, but to express it, being in some abusive or violent or chaotic environment.
Exactly. If Jerry Brudos was raised by any other set of parents, this may not have happened, even though he may have had a predisposition for violent behavior.
But also, you know, this whole thing about, you know, genetics starting it. I mean, I like to say genetics loads the gun, personality and psychology aim it, and experiences pull the trigger. And I think the place in which we exert our influence on where we go, what we do, what we become, is through the development of our personality and the millions of little tiny decisions you make in the privacy of your brain that you decide when you see that cat and you're curious about it and you do something to hurt that cat and it whines and cries and goes away. You decide that your curiosity is more important than the feelings of that cat or your little brother or sister or the kid down the street. You make those decisions and that's where your choice is. Your choice is to either reject or embrace the dark side that you recognize in your own life.
Well, let me throw out another cog in this wheel.
Okay.
You see a cat and you hurt the cat. What is it in your brain? There's a little part of your brain called the nucleus accumbens that sends out all this dopamine through your body, right, which makes you feel great. Someone right. else may hurt a cat out of curiosity, and they feel awful about it. So
right.
the empathy circuit and the way you're rewarded in the brain shapes you into either performing that act again or never performing it again. And some of that's based on how do you feel about it after you do it. We're all curious. We all do these things that are sometimes looked upon as being abhorrent. But when we're little kids, we all try. We pull the wings off of flies, for example, and then we move up to larger animals. And where is it when you move to a larger animal that you feel badly about what you've done versus getting this wash of dopamine and endorphins that say, oh yeah, that was cool, let me do it again.
Right, and that's, again, it's sort of like it feeds upon itself. This whole narcissistic aspect, I'm more important than everybody else. And, you know, and yes, some people, I believe, are born without the capacity for empathy. And those are the psychopaths, right? And,
yes.
And I think there are other people who have some, but who reject it. And the most important thing about everything we're talking about is everybody is on a spectrum. It's a continuum. Humans are not fit into little tiny little boxes, and you can't put everybody into a pigeonhole. There's a spectrum of behavior. There's nuances between each different person. But I think the most important thing that I wanted to bring out is that it is not simply if you have these attractions, if you know that you like to hurt people or sexually victimize someone, you don't have to act on it. You can
fight it. And you know what? There are a lot of people that don't. I know a guy, he has pedophilic tendencies, but he'll never act out those tendencies, he says.
Yeah.
And again, the literature has a lot of men who have admitted in therapy that that's their inclination, but they don't want to go through it.
Well, right. and let's hope they can control themselves.
Yes.
And you help them with coping strategies. But just to rewind a bit about the pulling wings off flies and putting frogs in microwaves. I mean, I was never wired in that way. I was never curious enough to want to.
Thank God.
Off flies. I don't know, you know, how everyone else feels, but I think, yeah, of course, there are a subset of people who do that, and, you know, as children, and we see them pulling, you know, cat's tails, and then they carry on. And, you know, I still think that a lot of that, of what's being released, is a power and control aspect, you know, and that's the experimentation, and that power and control is the thing that the individuals that we're talking about thrive on, whether it's Jerome Brudos, you know, and the power and control. And I love the way that Mindhunter portrayed the interviews with him, where, you know, in each of those serial killers who are trying to maintain the power and control over the FBI profilers, because that is what happens. And it's a game of chess majority of the time.
With serial killers, there's going to be that cooling off period, and that cooling off period will start to probably get shorter and shorter as they go along.
Well, there's another concept that we have to add, to the mixture of all of this. And Jerome Brudos, as do most serial killers, have a hatred ingredient here. He hated his mother.
Hatred of women.
Many of the women probably represented that. The ingredient that is added to all that mix is the hatred that most of these serial killers have, whether it's John Gacy for his father, or whether it's Gary Ridgway for his mother, or Brudos for his mother. And they show they get out these ways of showing this hatred. And of course, with Brudos, like most serial killers, they isolate. Their isolation turns to fantasies, what makes them feel good. What does Brudos fantasize about? The shoes that his mother burned. And then it moves on to feet. And then later he became he had a underwear fetish, a female underwear fetish. All those things were connected to his mother, whom he hated terribly, and which he generalized, which a lot of serial killers do, generalize their hatred from other objects to symbolic representations of them, who they kill.
Right. And whilst he can control his wife, who is much younger than him, Darcy, but she was with him for a significant amount of time. I mean, she was with him for 8 years. And, you know, to talk about the victims, because we always talk about them. Well, she was a victim. And the irony was that she was arrested after he was arrested.
She was.
Yes, which, you know, again, John, I mean, I've seen that in a number of cases, but she was...
Well, back in the 50s.
Conspirator, right?
Back in the 50s. You know, look at the difference between that and Dennis Rader. When Dennis Rader was arrested, no
BTK.
One had any thoughts of his wife being part of it. In fact, I think they expedited the divorce. They expedited her ability to take the house. Which I don't believe they ever spent the night in that house again. Compare that to the way we thought about serial killers in the 50s, where if a woman was involved with a serial killer, we thought everyone would know who these people are. And that if you're married to one, you have to know he's out killing. And, you know, the whole concept has changed since then.
Well, I'm not sure it's changed entirely, because I still speak to a lot of law enforcement about cases, you know, that are happening now. And, you know, we've got to think about what happened in Florida with the Pulse shooting, where the mass shooter, his wife was arrested and she was put to trial as if she was an accomplice. Well, she was being coercively controlled by him, and all the evidence showed she was being coercively controlled, but it was misunderstood. And I see a lot of cases where that still happens because we're still trying to educate people on what coercive control is. But I think, you know, going back to Jerome Brudos and his wife, Darcy, who's changed her name and lives elsewhere now, she was present in the house with a lot of the murders. So, you know, Linda Slauson was the first victim that was known about on January the 26th, 1968. She knocked on their door and she was selling encyclopedias, and he lured her into the basement. And it's there that he raped her, tortured her, took pictures of her.
And cut off her foot. And he cut off one of her feet.
Right, whilst his wife and children were home.
Well, actually what he had done was when she came and he was outside trimming the hedges. And incidentally, she did not make cold calls. She went to the wrong address. And when she went to his address, he was out there cutting the hedges. He took her into the basement garage area. Then he went upstairs and he gave his wife money for fast food and said, take the kids, go get some fast food. And they did. And then he goes down and that's when he kills her and cuts off her foot and keeps it in the freezer for several weeks until he decided he had to get rid of it.
So that he could put high heels on the foot?
Yes, he did. He put high heels on the foot that he had stolen and bought. And used it sort of as a foot model, so to speak.
Right. So she wasn't a part of the abduction and murder of Linda Slauson, the wife.
Oh, absolutely not. No.
She probably knew nothing about it. And Jan Whitney was the next victim, where she was driving home for Thanksgiving, her car broke down, and he stopped to help her.
Right.
Inverted commas. But he strangled her in the car and raped her and took pictures and cut off her breasts, I believe, or one breast.
He cut off her breasts and made an epoxy mold out of it, like a paperweight.
Right. I mean, you know, very sadistic individual, and took pictures. I mean, that, again, part of his paraphilia, but the pictures were an important part of the evidence, weren't they, in terms of...
Absolutely. In fact, he had mirrors all around his garage. Mirrors around the room where he hung these women, and he had taken the pictures. And what police found, as he's denying knowing anything about this, the police find one Polaroid picture of a woman hanging with him in the background taking the picture from the mirrors that he had installed around his workshop area.
And do you think that he had the mirrors because it multiplied the effect?
In absolutely other words,
that he was able to see multiple victims at once by looking in the mirrors and looking at the real victim.
He definitely liked to see himself with the victims.
Wow.
And that was part of the paraphilia. The mirrors, seeing himself with these victims, really excited him tremendously. It just made the sexual satisfaction that much greater.
Yeah, it really got him off, you know, harming women and torturing women and then spending time with them. And I think that's another important component. You know, he had them within his home and he was able to do whatever he wanted. And his wife, he'd set up an intercom system, hadn't he, so that she had to use the intercom if she was ever going to go into the basement. And I think the attic, there were a couple of rooms that were off limit and she had to use that intercom. She wasn't allowed to just walk in.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And obviously this is the reason why. The next victim was a 19-year-old student, Karen Sprinker, March 1969. So this is the next year. He abducted her from a parking garage,
mm-hmm.
and he took her home as well and removed her breasts.
Mm-hmm.
So he clearly wanted to spend time. You know, it wasn't just about killing a woman. It was about the spending of time. And, of course, because of all the fantasy element to this, that was the reason why. And he kept certain parts of them with him, like the breasts.
Well, even when he was a kid, just barely going into puberty, he had already had fantasies about having a place like a hole in the ground, a dungeon, a cave, where he could take women and keep them as slaves. He had that at a very young age. When he went to the army, he was released from the army because he had these sexual fantasies. At one point, he thought that there was a female coming into his room and him having sex with her. They actually diagnosed him with a form of schizophrenia, and then they released him, discharged him from the army. So he's had these fantasies of holding these young women in a place where he can play with them and do what he wants from a very early age.
And do you think, John, do you think that Gacy had something like that in his fantasies, because he buried so many of the boys and young men that he killed under his house? He was basically living right above them, despite the fact that it must have smelled horrifically in that house. Do you think that's part of his fantasy life?
I think that's a part of it. Another part of that situation is that his father was an alcoholic, and he always went down in the basement and drank before he came up and beat his wife and beat his children. And with Gacy symbolically killing his father over and over, if he had had a basement, I think he would have put him in the basement, but he didn't. He had a crawl space. So that's where he put him. So I think, yes, living over them or living with them, Kendall Francois lived over his, with his victims. Anthony Sowell did that in Cleveland. Even Dorothea Puente had them buried in her yard. Juan Corona buried them in and around his yard. So many of these killers keep the entire body. Look at Dahmer, keeping them in his apartment. Yeah. There is something to be said about having so much power and control over these people that even after death, you're still controlling at least their physical body.
Yeah,
and it's fantasy side of having them around. But he didn't keep, going back to Jerome Brudos, because I do want to just finish off each of the victims, because we do put the victim's narrative at the center of Real Crime Profile. Sure. And Linda Saley was the last victim, I believe, although maybe there were more, maybe you'll say something about that, John. But 14 weeks later, after Karen, he abducted 22-year-old Linda Saley from a shopping center and then took her back to his home address. And he kept her there, but he disposed of her body in the river, I believe, as well as Karen Sprinker's body in the river.
I think all of them he threw in the river.
And they were later found, and with unusual knots they had various different bits of metals from cars weighing them down, but there was an unusual knot that he used.
Mm-hmm.
And the other interesting thing that I discovered about this case was that he also targeted girls at the university. Of Oregon State University, where he was calling up women, trying to get dates with them. So he was kind of like a confidence trickster, you know, what we would call. He would use a ruse as well as abducting women. And there was one woman that he went out on a date with, and the police spoke to her.
They had a Coke together. They went out and had a Coke.
A soda.
She didn't really call it a date. A Coca-Cola.
Right, and this was the woman who told the police that there was a man that had talked about strangling her and about women's bodies in the river. And they said, if he ever calls again, you know, let us know. And she did let them know. And that's when he was arrested.
Exactly.
So not very, mixed modus operandi. And I think that's an important thing to highlight. You know, he would stalk women, but he would find women. He was an opportunist, i.e. when Linda Slauson knocks on the wrong door or is in the neighborhood. He manages to have the confidence and the interpersonal skills.
Well, the fantasy is, his fantasy was to be attractive to women, to have the confidence to ask a woman out. She accept, they go out. And was he going to kill them? Probably. But he still had that fantasy of wanting to be liked by women, which many of these serial killers want that, even if they're married. They still need to have that thought process of, I'm attractive to women and they will want me.
Of being desired or being validated or both?
All of it. Desire, validated, sort of a power reassurance as an anger retaliation. All of it at the same time.
Right. And this is whilst his wife is at home, unaware of all of this going on. And I think that's another very interesting point, that she's bringing up the children.
She's bringing up the children. He needs her. That's a symbol of normalcy. It's what keeps him not sane. I don't want to. It keeps him in a idea that everything is still normal. It's a pretend normal for him. And most of these serial killers who have families, the family serves a function for them besides the familial part. It keeps them grounded to some degree within the family unit and in the community, so right. that people will know, oh, well, he's a family man. He couldn't do stuff like
not
that.
Not a threat. Don't look this
like
way.
Like Gacy, when he was reported before, they didn't believe the boy that went and said that this guy took him to his house and tried to rape him and sadistically hurt him. They didn't even believe it.
Yeah, it's so shocking to see how they can be such high-functioning members of society.
And they're hiding.
Well,
such
they're very intelligent. Many of them are very intelligent. And even Gary Ridgway, with his 80-something IQ, who got away with it from 1982 to 2001.
The Green River
people
killer.
People say he must have been really smart, but no, he was street smart. Not academically smart, but he was street smart. So you have to look at the two types of intelligences here.
Yeah, right. Well, John, there's so much more that we want to talk to you about. This is really fascinating. And next week, we will continue our conversation. Thank you so much for coming. And till next time, thank you for listening. Signing off for Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.